Hi, Nessa from StudyClicks here. The following is the audio from a live webinar featuring StudyClicks CEO and co-founder Luke Saunders in conversation with child psychologist Dr. Richard Hogan. The webinar was recorded on the 8th of September 2025 and aimed to answer all the questions parents have about how best to support their child during the back-to-school period. Luke and Richard touch on important topics including the transition from primary to secondary school, coping with exam pressure, and the use of mobile phones. For more tips and free resources on how to support your child through secondary school, check out the Parent Centre on StudyClicks. The link is in the description of this podcast. I'll pass it over to the lads now. I hope you enjoy listening.
We'll kind of get started just for the sake of introductions, I suppose. My name is Amanda. My role at StudyClicks is kind of a schools engagement manager. My work is predominantly directly with schools, working alongside their teachers and their students to incorporate StudyClicks into the everyday teaching and learning of the school specifically. But I am far from the main attraction here this evening. I am joined by my colleague, Luke, who is the CEO and co-founder of StudyClicks, and he will be chatting with our special guest, Dr. Richard Hogan, this evening about all sorts of key topics around this back to school period and everything that comes with it. And from a housekeeping point of view, before I hand over to them, just to note that the webinar itself is being recorded. So if you miss out on anything or you want to go back over anything, we will, of course, be sharing that recording with you. But we're thrilled to have you here, of course, in a live capacity as well. At the end of the session, you won't hear from me again really until the end of the hour, but I will be kind of giving your questions directly to the two lads. So if you have anything that comes to mind or any questions you'd like to ask, feel free to use the chat feature in the Zoom call here, and I will happily relay as many questions as we can at the end of the session. So in that case, I'll wrap up here. Thank you very much again for attending and coming so on time. It's brilliant. And I'll hand over to the two lads.
Thanks a million, Amanda. And welcome to all the viewers, all the parents. As Amanda said, my name is Luke Saunders. I'm one of the founders of StudyClicks. I'm a former teacher of science and maths. And we set up StudyClicks about 12 years ago at this stage. Initially for me as a teacher myself to use with my own students and to share with my colleagues, but quickly over the years it grew to become what now is Ireland's largest teaching and learning website. So I presume you've heard of it if you're here tonight. If you haven't, go check it out. I'm also a father of three. My eldest is 11, so she's in sixth class and is going to be entering secondary next year, and then I've two younger ones, 9 and 6. And I suppose where the idea of tonight's webinar came from is that I'm based here in Sligo, and the guidance counsellors of various schools in Sligo had invited tonight's guests as a guest speaker to a talk. And I attended myself, and I couldn't get over, firstly, how many parents were at the event. And me as a parent, when I attended, I really just picked up so much for it. And I took notes, which I shared with my wife, who couldn't attend that night. And then those notes went sharing around WhatsApp groups, and people were contacting me saying, you know, will you send on those notes? I missed it. I heard it was a great talk. And at that, I realized, you know what? We have to have tonight's guest on with us. I think he's going to be a really, really important person for StudyClicks. And I'm delighted to say that he's become StudyClicks' parent advisor. So I'd like to just introduce family psychotherapist, author, former teacher, Dr. Richard Hogan. So welcome, Richard.
Luke, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on. And look, I'm really looking forward to this conversation and speaking to all the parents out there today. I have to say, when I met you up in Sligo, the first thing I said is, Jesus, I've been pushing StudyClicks for years, because as a teacher, I could see just how beneficial it is for kids, you know, for students, and how it cuts off a lot of the stuff that they don't, the extraneous stuff that they don't need. So I'm delighted to be working with you guys and speaking to your parents.
Great. No, we're delighted to have you. In terms of yourself, you might just tell the listeners, you have a couple of kids yourself. What age?
I do. I have three daughters and a little dog as well that's female. So I have four daughters. I live with five women. And my eldest daughter is 14, and my middle daughter is 11, and my youngest daughter is 8. So the 14-year-old is doing her junior cert this year.
Okay, interesting. And like, I suppose where I'll start, and there's so much we can get through, and
Sure.
I'll just touch on various bits, and we'll be jumping around a little. But obviously, back to school is a key time, right? So students are back for the last kind of 7 to 10 days.
Yep.
I think, when I was looking at the stats around the parents who've signed up to tonight's webinar, we've actually got a range of first years parents who don't have any older siblings, right through to parents of 6 years. I suppose one of the first questions I have is the back to school period. A lot of parents, realize now is a key time because it sets down habits and routines. What advice would you give to parents at this time of year when they're trying to establish those types of routines for their child?
Yeah, that's a great question because, particularly if your child has moved out of primary school into secondary school, or your student is going back into like maybe an exam year or just a second year, whatever it is that the transition back into school is. I think a really important thing, and I do it with my own kids here, and it's really important, particularly if they're in first year, is to ask really nice questions when they're coming home, like, what did you enjoy about today? Just some nice questions, because I often think we can frame it quite negatively to them, and so we get them thinking negatively. So I'd always start off with kind of like little nice questions along those kind of lines about particularly first year. But what I'd say to parents, going into first year, because that is probably one of the biggest life transitions we go through from that junior infants, primary school into secondary school, where you're going around to different classes, you're trying to figure out all the different teachers. It's an incredible amount of information going into a 12-year-old, mind there. And I would say always, if you can try to help them expand out their friendship group, because this is coming from my experience as a teacher for 25 years, I'd often see two friends coming in from the local school, into the secondary school, and by November that friendship has collapsed, and one person has moved off to like a group, and the other person's left behind. And that is devastating for a child, and they're having their lunch in the toilet and that. And so what I always say to parents, I've been saying it for so many years, try to widen out their friendship group, that may getting them involved in some activities, getting them into the swimming, the scouts, the GAA, whatever it is that they might find a more friends in. That's what I'd be trying to get them to think about. But also importantly, say for any student going back, and we know, look, from all the research, and looking at all the data, it's all about consistency. It's not about incredible amounts of study in one go. If you go to the gym, it's not about how much you lift in one go. It's about what you do consistently over the course of a month, over the course of 2 months. And that's what I've been trying to do with my own daughter upstairs, who's studying for the junior cert this year. I'm saying to her, it's not about massive study here. It's about having a nice plan. And then I always get this, particularly with if you have boys, they find it hard often to visualize themselves. They don't work so well in the consistency as maybe girls might. They struggle with the idea of like organization, and they struggle with consistency. And that's why I think the data would show that they underperform in exams. And what I'm always trying to do when I'm working with particularly boys is try to get them to visualize their future self. I get them to think about this time next year, kind of around now, the exam results will be coming out. How do you want to feel? I get them to say, yeah, I'd like to feel good. And I'd say, well, okay. What would make you feel good over the course of these 9 months? What will make that guy, say that Richard, feel good? So I get them to really think in the interest of their future self. I get them to think about their future self, because they can really maybe have a bit of a blind spot there about their future self, and they just kind of like, drift through the year. And what you're trying to say is, no, you're in control here. You're in control of how you feel soon. And if you do the right preparation, not excessively studying, because that's not good, not cutting off your friends, not cutting off your sports, keeping all that stuff going, right? And changing what the exam means. The exam is a chance to kind of express yourself. It's not a fearful thing. It's a chance to go in there once you've done the preparation and see what happens. And so if you kind of think about it like those terms, it's not terrifying. It's not like Everest. It's actually something that might be exciting. And I work a lot with students who come into my clinic, and they come for this kind of, psychological little just like tweak and reframing about, this is not an Everest, this is not insurmountable. This is actually a chance to kind of show what you do, your process. And I don't think personally, having done loads of exams all myself through my life and done badly in some exams, when I think about my junior cert, didn't do so well there, but that was the impetus to do well in my leaving cert, because I knew the process wasn't correct. I figured out listening to Bob Dylan wasn't going to help me with my history exam, but it took me, that experience to figure out you have to have processes in place to do well. And so it would be about sitting down with them and kind of going through that. You'll have your friends, you'll have your phone, you'll have your time to that, but here's the process that you need to put into place.
Yeah, I think that point is really strong. The one about goal setting.
Yeah.
If a student knows why they're
Exactly.
studying so much easier. I see it a lot, like when I would go in and talk with students in schools that they use StudyClicks. And one of the biggest things I'd say is get a goal. If you know why you're doing this, it's because I want to do a particular course in college and I need this amount of points. It makes the whole reason for studying clear, and therefore it's much easier to do. Just to pick
Absolutely.
up on a point you made there, about, I think a difficult transition for students, or certainly for us parents, is that like they come out of national school, right? And they don't, the level of testing that they're doing, it's like they might do the Drumcondra tests or their weekly
Yeah.
spelling tests. And then suddenly we land them into first year and we're like, right, you've got 51% in maths and 28% in Irish. And then we start streaming them in second year. And I think that must really be difficult for a student who's not used to kind of putting a number on their head, and then suddenly the
Yeah.
parent is putting pressure on. Like, how as a parent do we kind of deal with the first report if there's results there that you don't like? Because you don't want to overload the student with pressure either.
No, you're
You
right.
want to help,
It's such a really important question for your child's mental health and their ability to think about themselves. Because I don't think anything will disrupt the neurochemistry in a brain like a result that's quite negative, and then you get streamed. And so then you have a thought about yourself that you're not that clever, right? I mean, I think that can be one of the most destructive things that we get into our thinking. It actually changes the neurochemistry in the brain. And so what happens is the thought then becomes actually confirmed for you. I'm not that clever. That becomes a pathway. And so that means it's the only thought available to you. When you think about yourself, I'm stupid, right? And then here's where it goes. I say this in talks all the time. I talk to thousands of students, a lot, big talks, and I'd say, does this thought sound familiar? If I don't study, and when I don't do well, at least I can say I didn't study. And they're all sitting going, Jesus, yes, that makes perfect sense to me. And that gets born, that the roots of that awful thought is born in an exam where they don't do so well. And what I'm at pains to tell my own children, and when I'm working clinically or when I'm in schools giving talks, you don't know what your potential is just yet. You're trying to figure out what it is that you might be interested in. And not doing well in an exam doesn't define you whatsoever. It just means that you didn't do particularly well at that exam. So that's a learning moment. What's going on there? What was my process like? If you really listen to what that means, rather than translating it as I'm stupid and say, well, maybe I'm not that interested in maths. I'm thinking of the two subjects I didn't do so well in school. Maths would have been one that I would have struggled with. English I would have had very high levels of, but maths would have been one I didn't do particularly well at. And so I was trying to figure out, okay, so maths, do I want to be a mathematician? Do I ever see myself lecturing in maths in Trinity? I don't think so, right? And so you're just trying to calibrate yourself in a way that doesn't impact on your mental health. And the way I'd always say it to students is like, if I walk into the maths department in Trinity, I'm probably, one of the least competent in that room. But if one of the maths department walks into the psychology department, he's probably one of the least competent in our department. And so it doesn't mean he's stupid or clever. It just means your interests lie elsewhere. And when you figure out what your interest is, this is really important to tell your child. Like, when you figure out what your interest is, you don't know it yet. That's okay. That's normal. I do think the whole education system, as we have it currently, sets children up to have very negative self-talk, right? And so you don't know what you want to do yet. That's exciting because everything is on the table here. And if you do a bad exam, that's just an exam that you didn't perform that well in. We don't collapse under it. This is what I'm always saying to people. And I work with a lot of athletes as well, at high levels. I'm saying we have the courage to go for something, but in the understanding that we won't always do a really good exam, in the understanding that we won't always get a H1 or that we won't always do really well. And when I was teaching for years, I'd always say when I was doing my 6-year course in fifth year, I'd start off and say, look, on the way to a H1 here, there can be plenty of H3s and H4s. There might even be an H5. It's how you respond to those moments will make the difference. And so what we're trying to help our children, because I think we do have an epidemic of perfectionism where they're terrified to make mistakes or they're terrified to underperform an exam. And that almost paralyzes them, because they don't even want to do the exam. They're rigid going into the exam, And so what they have to understand is everybody does bad exams from time to time, and that's actually a learning moment, and you analyze what happened in the process. Or is it actually, I'm not that interested in biology, is that a subject that I'm really that keen on? Well, maybe I'm just going to grind out a few points out of this thing for the Leaving Cert, but ultimately it's not where my interest lies. And what I'm always telling students is, like, your talent and your kind of, like, you know, your ability, that will come true when you figure out what it is that you're kind of interested in. And then you meet that interest with your passion and your energy and your determination. Then you excel.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's when you say that, like when I was teaching, the parent teacher meetings used to have the student, so you'd have the parent and their child sitting in front of you. And I couldn't get over how often a parent had come up to me, and I'd be, oh, hi, Mr. Saunders, I'm the maths teacher. And suddenly the first thing they'd say is, oh, I was terrible at maths. I was terrible at maths. Sure, child's name is also terrible. And they're putting their experiences onto their child. I would always caution against doing that, because you're telling your child this isn't your subject, or
well. The way I put it, it's such a good point. The way I always put it, I think it just succinctly, I've said this for years, you know, labels don't predict the future, they write them. And so when you say, I'm not good at maths and my child won't be good at maths, you're writing a paradigm for them. You know what I mean? You know yourself as a teacher, you live out those paradigms. You know, and there was a very famous study that I won't go into now called Pygmalion in the classroom. It was carried out in the 60s, and it was looking at that idea of, like, self-fulfilling prophecy, because that's the self-fulfilling prophecy. And honestly, if you want your child to change how they talk to themselves, which is the most important thing about your child going forward in life, you know, change how you talk about them when you think they're not listening. You know, change that conversation about them not being good at something. You know, try to reframe it from not being good at it. You know, I think what you're saying there is so important, that we don't say, well, I was bad at maths, so you must be bad at maths. It's just, like, you know, allow them to figure it out for themselves.
Yeah, 100% agree. And, like, we've kind of touched on students who are kind of struggling to get started, or they're struggling with confidence. But there is another end of the spectrum where you might have a child who's actually doing a little bit too much, and you're worrying about that. They might be perfectionist. Have you come across that in clinics? Or
that's one of the biggest problems. It's one of the biggest. There's five big personality traits, right? There's conscientiousness is one of the big personality traits, and if you have that in the higher level, it can often move into perfectionism, and that's a very cruel thing to be mastered by, because there is no perfect, and there's no perfect exam, and there's no perfect game, and there's no perfect pass, and there's no perfect relationship, and there's no perfect conversation, so there's no perfect person. And so when you're driven by this desire to be perfect, it's often in that kind of, like, you know, it's often in a fear or an anxiety about themselves. That's where it kind of comes out of. It can come out through, like, obsessive thinking, ritualistic thinking, you know, or tapping, and it moves into kind of pathological kind of stuff. And so what I'm always trying to, and I work with this a lot, and often in my research, I often found that, like, accountants and lawyers, their children can often have really high levels of conscientiousness, where they are trying to be perfect all the time. And it's brutal to live in that headspace, because they never celebrate anything they get. When they do get 98 in exam, there's two missing. You know what I mean? When they get a H1, it's still not perfect. And even if they did get 100, you know, I've often had students over the years who got 400 out of 400 in English, you know, but they didn't get, let's say, that in every subject, but they got it in some subjects. So it's never enough.
Yeah.
You know, and what you're trying to do is help them out of that position to say, you know, why does it have to be enough? And this is the way I'd always ask as a parent, who's the first person they ring when they'd get a result? You know, maybe that's the person that they're trying to prove themselves to, you know, and think about that. Why would my child be trying to prove themselves to me? What's going on in our dynamic here that maybe they feel that they have to be perfect? And, you know, it's that old golf book, you know, golf is not a game of perfect. Life is not a game of perfect. It's not going to go perfectly. And if you're expecting it to go perfectly, and you're expecting the perfect result all the time, you will be miserable. And I work with so many teenage girls, particularly, who really struggle with this paradigm. And it can feed into, like, you know, image, body image, into dieting, food. It can, you know, it can self-harm. It can really, you know, morph or metastasize into their lives, you know, fully. And so I'd always be trying to get my child to be a little bit more spontaneous able to manage themselves and not be so controlling, because it's about control. You know, they want to control absolutely everything. And I would be trying to break that idea about kind of control, you know. And here's a key thing I'd always say to them. I always have these little phrases, because when I'm working with adolescents, they love little things that they can think about, little phrases. I'd say, you know, I'd say to them, does control mean a lot to you? The word control. And they'd say, oh God, Richard, Jesus, yeah. That's all I've ever wanted, is to feel in control. And I'd say, well, how did the pandemic go for you? And they'd say, oh, it was terrible. I started to, you know, monitor my food. I started to restrict. I started to do this. I started to do that. So they'd tell you all about what's going on. I'd say, okay. I'd give them this phrase. I'd say, when you try to exert so much control over your life, do you feel in control? And they'd say, absolutely not. And I'd say, so the thing that you use to make yourself feel more in control is the thing that gives you less control. And they'd say, yes. And I'd say, well, you're going to have to take control of not having control. And that gives you control. The more you can accept of the things that you can't control, the more in control you are of your life. When you try to exert absolute control over everything, as you know, we're not that in control of most things, right? And the biggest fear is what's going to happen next. And so that type of mind that's hyper-conscientious wants to understand everything. And it's a paradigm that really is destructive, and you're trying to help your child out of it. And that phrase has helped so many teachers. They say to me, that really helped me. Because when those thoughts come in to check the door, to check under the bed, to whatever it is, to do my homework, to do it again, I say to myself, take control of not having control. That gives you control.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. And like, what I heard a lot there is like a conversation and a dialogue between parent and child, right?
Yeah,
and
possibly.
I think, like, if you take a typical secondary school child's day these days, it's like they're waking up, they're having breakfast maybe with a family, but it's first thing in the morning, no one's talking to anyone. They commute to school, they go to school, they might play sports in school directly after school. They come home, they do their homework, they gobble down the dinner, they might go off and do another sport. When is all this dialogue between parent and connection and talking about their feelings and their well-being so difficult with all this stuff that's going on?
It is, yeah. You're right. That's a great point, Luke. The busyness of life. And I just want to say to all the parents listening out there, you know what I mean? We all get it right and wrong. Me included, you know what I mean? We have to give it. We're in the age of TikTok and we're and Instagram, and we're all victims of that too. And we hear all about the perfect parenting. And as I was saying about conscientiousness and perfection, there is no perfect parent. Me neither. You know, when I shout up to my daughters, my middle daughter will say, oh, look, the family therapist is shouting at us, lads. You know, none of us are getting it right all the time. We're all in this thing together. And the only fights I have with my daughter, eldest one, is about the phone and all that, like everybody, every other parent. But what I'd always say to parents is we're trying to minimize the amount of conflicts in our lives. We're trying to have better strategies. And that's what this seminar is about, how to develop some better strategies. I'd always think, what time is my daughter, particularly my eldest one now, more likely to have a chat with me? It's not going to be first thing in the morning. You know what I mean? That's not what we're going to say, how are things going? But when I've noticed over the years, when she comes home from school, she's far more chatty and far more open. So that's where I might have the conversation. Or even in the evening before, like, you know, where, you know, as we're getting ready for bed, I often find she might really give me some nice information there. And what I've noticed with boys, working with them over the years, you know, they love a chat in the bus or in the car when you're not looking at each other and you're looking out the window separately, or you're not making too much eye contact. So I try to figure out the time during the day when, you know, is the best time to have these conversations. And sometimes they just pop up organically. And so you know your child better than anybody. Just say to yourself, when are they more likely? When are they less likely? When do we have the most conflict? You know, that's not the time. When are they more, maybe when they're coming home and they're angry and hungry and all that kind of stuff and they're tired, that's not the time to kind of go, well, tell me what happened today in school. Because you might just get a grunt, you know. I'd be kind of trying to figure out when is the best time for this child to talk to me, what's going on? Figure that out. And then think about what kind of questions do I ask? You know, because that's a really important thing, you know. How do I ask a question that isn't narrow and shuts the conversation down? How do I let it open up, you know, what's going well for you at the moment? Just let them go off, let them riff on that, you know. What are you enjoying about school at the moment? Just let them riff on that. You might get, oh God, nothing. I'm enjoying nothing, but you'll hear what's kind of going on and all that. But again, you're right, we are incredibly busy. And can I just say this other thing to parents listening? 47.2, Luke, is our most unhappy year as adults, right? And 14 is our most unhappy year as a teenage girl, and 15 in my research is the most unhappy year for a teenage boy, right? So girls are just ahead of the boys always during adolescence, right? And so we're getting married around 32, and so we're having a kid at around, we're getting married 30, 32, so we're having a child maybe 33, 34. So they're up there that when we're 47 and having a dip in our happiness, they're down there in adolescence having a dip in their mental health also and their happiness. And so we can be like, clashing a lot with our 14-year-old and our 15-year-old. And what I just want to say to parents is that's absolutely normal. There's huge hormones going on in the family at that particular time. And there's loads of pressure on us as parents with our own parents getting elderly. So there's huge pressures here. And our own teenager mightn't be leaning on us as much. And we might feel a little bit of loss there. And so that's all the normal kind of journey as your child moves towards adulthood, because that's identity formation. And sometimes in my analysis, to form their identity, they have to kind of push you away to form their own identity, because they want to be different from you. They don't want to be the same as you. You're their parents. So that they often it feels like rejection, and so there can be a lot of tension in the house. I'm just saying to parents, that's normal, and if you kind of just pull back from it and don't see it as loss, this is the key I'd always say to parents, and I've lived this myself. Think about being with your teenager, being together differently at this particular period. They're going through an incredible amount of growth and development and identity and all that, and they're trying to figure out the world and who they are in the world. And we were all teenagers. We all know what that was like. And so as parents, if we understand a little bit more of that, and rather than feeling the hurt of what feels like rejection, we might be in a little bit of better supporting role there.
Yeah, it's like I think it's a really important point that we're both at peak anxiety at
Yeah,
the time, yeah,
exactly,
symptoms.
exactly, yeah.
And I think also that, if I think back to my own childhood and my parents parenting me, I don't think they were as worried about being a good
No, they
parent
weren't.
as we
No,
are.
no, no.
Like I called my mother today to tell her I was doing this webinar, and we had a quick chat, and I was like, "What were your tips for being such a good parent?" And she was like, "I can't remember," she said. So I just don't think that generation, with social media, it has its effect on our kids, but it also has an effect on us as parents, where there's a lot of guilt, and it's like, am I doing it right? And is my child abnormal in some way because they're not doing this or they are doing that? And there's a lot of pressure to be a parent in 2025, like.
Oh, geez, no doubt. And I think you're right. And I think like parenting and growing up and all the rest of it was irrevocably different when my parents were going. You know what I mean? It's just a different world. It was a different thing. And they didn't consider children mental health. They didn't think about a child's feelings. Parents said terrible things to kids. You know what I mean? And I was in school in the 80s. Jesus, a kid with dyslexia. I mean, that was a kind of a brutal thing to experience and all the rest of it, because they didn't consider mental health. So that was a different time altogether. Maybe we have maybe overcorrected a little bit. And that's what I'd say, that we're overly invested in our children. We're overly concerned about what's kind of going on in their real life, and probably not enough concerned in what's going on in their online life. We need to kind of overcorrect. We need to correct that a little bit more, and we need to kind of let them out a little bit more, to experience the world like we did. And I think that those are very important kind of aspects of modern parenting, that perhaps because of how we came up and not being validated and all the things, all the rest of it, that and both parents generally have to work today to meet the financial demands, and the all of that kind of stuff about our society. So we should never parent. This is what I'm always saying. We should never parent from a position of guilt because we're both working. We can feel guilt, and shameful, and our parents might say, "Jesus, you never see the kids. You're out working." We can't parent from that position of guilt because we tend to give away our agency.
Interesting. And a conversation about parenting in 2025 wouldn't be complete without talking about phones. In StudyClick's world, we do a survey of students once a year, and last year we did it of 3,706 years, so
Brilliant.
the oldest students, and we talked to them about the relationship they have with their phones, their screen time use. I often go out and speak in schools, and I'd ask students to take out their phones and look at the screen time app, and it's something I'd advise parents could do with their child. It's just, it's very hard when a student is 17 or 18 years old to kind of parent them to control their phone use. But if you make them self-aware of just how much they're using it and what they're using it on, if they're on 7 or 8 hours in a day on screen, according to their screen time, it's going to have an effect, whether we like it or not. And often while they're in bed and all this type of thing. So what the findings were that like one in five students said that it's the biggest source of conflict between them and their parents is the phone.
Yeah.
And 75% said their parent doesn't monitor their online activity in any way. So my question to you, Richard, is there's probably two parts to it. With the youngest students who are just getting their first phone, like your daughter, for example, what boundaries do you put in place? And then I suppose the follow-up question to that is, there'll be many parents listening in tonight who they're kind of, the horse is bolted, the child is using the phone as much as they want. What do you do in that case to kind of regain control? So it's you could talk all night about this one, but
I could because I was noticing in my clinic around 2015, things were changing dramatically about, you know, because I'm a family therapist and I work with families for so many years, and I could see there was a stark change in what was coming in the clinic door and what the conversations were and what the conflict was about, right, in families. And I could see the devastation that technology and gaming for boys and social media for girls was causing in the lives of parents and the family dynamics, you know. And it was, without being dramatic, it was really tearing families apart. And then I was going around talking in schools all the time and to parents, and I just remember so many parents standing up, particularly on 2016, saying, you know, I've lost my family, can you help me get it back? What do I do? My husband brought the games in and the boys are gone now, and you know, and there's so many. That's why I wrote Parenting the Screenager. I was thinking, right, I have to write a practical guide to just try to get it out there so that people can just like follow practical steps. The first thing is, which is really important before this phone comes into your child's life, is to understand they're not a phone. You know what I mean? You're talking about endless internet access. So we call them phones, but it's endless internet access. And so it has everything the internet has, the good, the bad, and the absolutely very ugly, right? And so once you bring that into your child's life, there's no going back. And so my top tip always is to kind of delay it as long as you can get away with it. For us, it was going into first year. Right. And my daughter was saying to me in fourth class, and my eldest daughter, you know, my friends have phones, why can't I have one? I said, you're not getting one in primary school. I'm sorry about that. Fifth class, she was saying to me, you know, no one, everyone has, I'm the only one without a phone, you know, Dad, I'm the only one without a phone. I said, look, I get it. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. And she said, in sixth class, Dad, this is actually quite embarrassing. I remember one day it was funny. She said, a girl came up to me in school and she said, it's your dad's fault I don't have a smartphone. And I said to her, well, now you see, you're not alone. The two of you now don't have a smartphone. You can set up a little group. And she didn't care for my humor there. And, you know, and so you're, as parents, we're fighting this thing. And I was saying, delay it as much as possible. If we could all be in a community, this requires a community response, Luke. This is a global phenomenon. This isn't just an Irish phenomenon. I work in the Philippines with a charity. I see it right there, you know, in Asia. This is a global phenomenon. So the first tip is like, try to delay it as long as possible. Understand that it's not just a phone. It's an endless internet access with all that will bring into your child's life. Pornography, I mean, you know, Snapchat, which is particularly problematic because messages disappear. Snapchat as a platform is really problematic. I work with An Garda Síochána many times, you know, with really heavy cases. And, you know, it's Snapchat is where this stuff happens. And then the subtle bullying, the subtle exclusion. You know, exclusion is particularly hard for adolescents because in adolescents, brain regions associated with peer reinforcement and feedback are more sensitive. And so when you're excluded, your brain literally fires, as in the part that is experiences pain, the same part fires, the dorsal portion of the anterior cingulate cortex is a part of the brain that tells you you hurt your hand. That fires, and so your child is literally being hurt when they're being excluded by the girls going down to Starbucks and they put it up in Snapchat and then you're at home. It's awful. You're sitting at home watching all the girls. I didn't get invited. So there's all of this that's in there, right? And there's even more sinister stuff in there. And then, of course, there's nice stuff in there. They put an image up and you look stunning, babe. Gorgeous, babe. Love your lashes, girl. Beautiful, XX. There's all that kind of nice stuff in there too. So it's not all terrible, but there is the potential for calamity, right? So you delay it. But then here's the most important thing. When you hand it to your child, like I did with my daughter, you lay out the rules. Yourself and your partner, right? You know, or if you're a single parent, you know, I'm trying to figure out what my rules are here. You know, what's the culture I want to set? Because setting the culture early, children will accept the world that you create for them. If you're steadfast in it, you know, and if you're solid in it, they will accept it. If it's inconsistent and it's kind of chaotic, it's going to be anxiety provoking, it's going to cause loads of conflict, and it's going to be really problematic when they're 16 or 17 when they tell you to feck off. I'm not doing that, right? So when they're 12 or 13, you can really bring in a nice boundary. And so the boundary I would have is no phone in the bed at night. This is what I have in my own house. Between 5 and 7, there's no phone. Right. And so when you get home from school, you can have the phone for an hour or whatever it is. But then between 5 and 7, that's homework and that's whatever it is. And that's dinner with us. And that's just a respite from your phone. But then between 7 and 9, you can have your phone. And then the phone is gone after that. Now, my daughter and myself have fights about this, but it's kind of stopped now. But there was, you know, like anything where there's power, there's resistance. And she was resisting the power there. But, you know, it didn't change. It moved a little bit, but it didn't change. And what I'd say to parents is a key tip around this is, like, you know, hold on to your parental agency and your authority. No child wants to live in a family where there isn't that, right? But children crave boundaries. Yes, they will push them, right? And the image I always have is that of like a roller coaster. You push that thing, right? You don't push it to see will it open, you push it to see will it hold you. Right. And it's the same about boundaries when you set them up for your children. Your children will push them, but to see are they held? Are they safe? And so these things actually make the world less anxiety provoking. Right. And so having good boundaries, really clear and outlining, you know, and expecting this is the most important thing when you're setting boundaries, expect them to break them and have an idea about what you'll do when they break them. You don't annihilate their spirit. Right, that's an authoritarian boundary. That's like brutal. You know, when you take the games, you throw them in the bin. You know, you take your daughter's phone off her for like a month. You're cutting off her whole social world. Don't do those things. You know, be very clear about the punishment. If you can't manage the games yourself, you won't have them tomorrow, and then you can have them half the time the following day. And just a nice little boundary, and so that your child is learning to manage themselves. Because ultimately, what any of us want, Luke, here is that our daughters or our sons go off into the world and they can make good decisions when we're not there. And boundaries are the cornerstone of that because they learn the consequences of their behavior. So boundaries are not just about the phone; they're about setting them up to understand that their behavior has consequences. And if I choose that behavior, I choose that consequence. And so if I go on my 18:30 holiday after, you know, the leaving cert, if I drink and swim, I could drown. If I jump across this balcony, I could break my leg. That they're learning how, you know, their behaviors have consequences, and that starts very early. And so having clear boundaries that they agree to. Before I remember saying to my daughter, before I give you this, now she would have promised me the world there for that thing, right? Before I give you this, I said to her, these are the rules. Do you agree? And she said, yes, I do. Right? Yes, I do.
And if you haven't given the rules, which I'm sure there are many of the older
Absolutely.
groups, and the child is coming up with every excuse under the sun, you know, I'm using it for study, I'm etc. What do you do if the horse is bolted?
Yeah, it's a really important thing. Is most parents might be living with this at 15, 16, 17-year-old, kind of figuring out what do we do here? You know that it's out of control. You know that they can't manage this thing because this thing is addictive. It alters your mood. It fires serotonin, you know, and it fires dopamine, all these kind of things. And so it's like, okay, this thing is impacting on their mood. It's impacting on their ability to get up in the morning. It's impacting on them going to school. It's impacting on our relationship. I would always say with this, you can't bring in too many changes too quickly, right? When you haven't had boundaries, Luke, it's about because like too much change is too much for children, particularly 15, 16-year-olds. And so you're trying to bring in a change that you can manage. And so you're trying to do, I'd be saying to myself, well, what's the one thing I really want to stop? Because I can't stop it all in one go, but I can incrementally, slowly, slowly bring in a boundary. And I'd say, okay, and I do this all the time. This is the meat of most of my work during the day, clinically speaking. And I ask teenagers. I only had a teenager today who I asked this question to, because she was having a fight with her mom, and she was saying, "Mom's too strict," blah blah blah. And I said, "Would you? How would you like it to be?" And she said, "I'd like no rules." And I said, "Honestly, no. Would you like to be just given your phone and say off you go as much as you want?" She said, "No, not really." Right? And I don't think any child wants that. You know, no child that I've ever known said, "I must thank my parents for never having rules and never really putting bound." I've never met that. I've met the opposite, where I said, "My parents were a bit strict, but I understand why now." You know. And so here's the thing: I'd pick one idea that I think I might be able to win. And so what I do is I'd never bring it in as a punitive thing against my, let's say you have a 16-year-old son and they're gaming away all the time and you're kind of pulling out your hair, kind of going, what are we going to do here? And maybe one parent is a little bit more permissive than the other, and one parent is kind of going, Asher, it's only gaming. And then you're kind of going, Jesus Christ, what are we going to do? You know, what am I going to do? I'd say always pull one, what is the one win you'd want? The one thing I'd want if I could change it would be the phone out of the bedroom at night. That's a major thing. And so I'd say as a family, we're deciding to, like, you know, as a family, we're trying to decide to have better rules because I'm up late in my phone as well. And I think we're all, let's all, as a family, let's see how we do this. So you're not saying it's because of you, Luke, you're out of control here. You're saying as a family, we're going to give this a go for 2 weeks and see how we get on. And yeah. just bring it in.
Yeah, in a common place in the house.
Yeah, leaving the exactly. You know, leaving it in the bedroom, they're going to get around it. They have ways around it and all the rest of it. You know what I mean? They're too clever. They are natives of this stuff. And so they're too clever. I'd say, we're going to leave it down here. We're going to charge it overnight. Here's your new alarm clock. And let's just see it as a family. Just trying to make, as a family, let's just see how we get on with this. And I guarantee you, once they do it for a week or two, they won't go back.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like I would have done a lot of trips out to Achill Island, for example, as a teacher, and we would make the students, they would get their phones, they'd have to put them all in this kind of box, and then I would keep the box for the day, and then they'd get them for 30 minutes at 8 o'clock to check their messages, say to their parents that they're doing well, and then back in the box. And I remember on the bus home talking to some of the students, I was like, how did you actually find it without the phone for a full week? And they're all like, it was so nice just to be, you know, unconnected for a while. And they meant it not in a way that we as adults would go, oh, isn't it great? It's the fresh air and all. It was just not to have the pressure of checking your phone.
Of checking of streaks. Yeah. You know what I mean? I have a charity in the Philippines and I bring out students every year for 2 weeks. And one of the things is that there's no phones for the 2 weeks. And I often get students coming up to me and they might be in Trinity or UCD and they'd say to me, particularly students who might be in, like, you know, fifth year, would say to me, what will I do about my Duolingo streak? No, seriously. And they've been genuine. Yeah. Like I'm saying, seems like a you problem there, buddy, if you want to come to the Philippines. You know, I remember another girl said, get your sister to keep your streak going. And that is how pernicious these streaks are. You know, they imprison our children. And so we should always try to get them respite for 24 hours once a month just to give it up. I do that in our house. You know, we just let's just give it up for a night and see how we get on.
Yeah, yeah. I see. And I'm just looking at some of the questions popping in and we will turn to questions shortly. But what I'm seeing is the volume of questions that are coming in, we won't possibly get to them all this evening. But what we will do is record them and do another webinar in the future where we go through them. But just one final question before I get on to the audience questions, because I just see it popped up, is like there's a trade-off between you as a parent knowing that your child wants some level of privacy, but then you as a parent knowing to keep them safe, you might have to check their phone. And I'm interested to hear that dynamic. Like with your child, is it okay to do a spot check of a 14-year-old child's phone and go, I'm going to have a look at your phone because I gave it to you and I'm your dad? Or is it no, she's her own person now and I respect her and trust her? So that dynamic, where do you sit on that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Again, Luke, these are really important questions for parents, you know, to hear the answer to, because I will always answer these questions when parents ask me, how much time is enough time? How much is too much time? I'll always ask that, because a lot of experts try to hide what they feel about that. And then, absolutely, yes, I do this to my own child, right? Mm-hmm. And my own daughter would say to me at the start, what about my privacy? And I used to always say to her, who says you get all this privacy, right? And, you know, parents would say to me, am I invading her privacy? And I'd say, well, I'd put it like this. I'd say, well, if your daughter was going to a party and there was a load of drunk men in there, would you be invading her privacy by going into that house to see what's going on? Or would you actually be parenting and keeping her safe? And the research would say 33% less likely to get involved in risky behavior when you are actually monitoring what's going on. Now, I don't mean monitoring every single thing. I'm not monitoring our chats. I'm not, like, you know, overly dictatorial or despotic. But I will say to her from time to time, let me have a look at your phone and say, who the hell is that? He looks about 40. Who the hell is he? She said, I don't know. He's just someone who sent me. He sent me a request. I said, you block him. When that comes in, you block a man who looks like my age. You block that, or you block anyone you don't know. And you don't accept You don't accept people. So you're having this kind of like, upskilling all the time with her so that she understands. And there'd be some images I'd say to her, take that down. I'm not happy with that image there. I don't like that. Right? You take that down. And you're too young to be putting that image up there. She said, oh, my friends. And it's true, all her friends would be doing these poses and doing these TikTok things. I'd say, I know, but I don't want it. Take it down. And that's just being involved in your child's life. And again, knowing their friends, inviting their friends into your house, staying in their lives while they're trying to push away from you a little bit is really tricky, but it's doable. And again, yes, you do check their phone from time to time. And
Yeah,
yes, you ask them a question. But can I just say this too, because it's really important too. When I was giving my daughter the phone, I said to her, I will not take this phone off you when things don't go well. And I've never taken the phone off her because I've worked clinically with this for so many years and I've worked with An Garda Síochána. And I've sat where 15-year-old boys and girls said to me, they got kind of catfished and somebody really did horrible things to them and got them to send images and really forced them to send terrible images. And my question was like, why didn't you go to your parents? And they said, every answer I got back to that question was because my parents take the phone off me. And so I'd say, don't use it as a parenting tool. Have other things, because it's very powerful. I could say to my daughter, give me the phone, and she will correct her behavior immediately because you're cutting off her friendship. You're cutting her right out of her friendship group. And so when things go wrong on this thing, which it will, as in she gets sent images or something happens, they won't come to you because they're terrified you're going to cut them off. And so I said, I won't take it off you. I mightn't be happy about what's happened, but we'll support you with it. And she did have an issue and she came to us about it, and we didn't take the phone off her. Right. And so, and life moved on. And so, it's a very important thing because if you're taking the phone off your child willy-nilly as a parenting tool, they just learn not to trust you to come to you about issues that's happening on it. And as you know, and as you'll know, when your child moves into 13, 14, they'll be on this thing. And this is a particularly complicated thing to be on for a young person. There will be issues there, and you want them to be able to talk to you.
Yeah, you want to keep the line of communication open for
Absolutely.
sure. I'll just before we jump into the questions, I just want to share you briefly. I hope we can see my screen here. Just some basic. This is the basic stuff, but just some apps that might be helpful to you guys.
Yeah, great.
Google Family Link and Apple Screen Time, depending on which services you use. But essentially, what it does is it allows you to set up your child on an app on your phone and monitor what they're using. And also set limits. There's another one I would suggest called Custodio, which a friend of
Audio is
mine,
good. Yeah.
very much recommended. And this is the report from her child's activity. So she's able to show exactly what screen time he's had. She can lock certain apps to only a certain amount of time, right? So you could say, I'm putting a max limit of 90 minutes on TikTok per day or an hour on Snapchat. So it gives you back control. Again, it'd be something that's very hard to retrofit if the ship has sailed on that. In Study World, I always recommend to students this one called Forest App. It's really good for keeping them focused on a task. It's a free app. And what it does basically is that it gamifies attention. So basically, if they study in a 25-minute block without picking up their phone, it plants a little tree. And if they do pick up their phone while they're meant to be studying, it kills one of the trees. And it's so simple, but it really does gamify the learning experience. Just one other thing to note, just a reminder if anyone joined late, the discount code, if anyone does want to buy a subscription to StudyClicks, 10 € off with webinar 10, that'll work for this month. So just enter webinar 10 when you're buying anything. Some parents out there will have StudyClicks access, or their child might have it through the school, but there's also optional extras that you can get, like Boost. If they need any extra help in maths, check out studyclicks.ie/boost, or they can always upgrade to the premium. If you have any questions for us, you can always come to us on the on info@studyclicks.ie. And just one other thing to note is we have a thing called Parent Center, studyclicks.ie/parent center, where we're going to put up a lot of the content that you saw tonight. And I would also suggest sign up for our newsletter on that same webpage. So you just go to studyclicks.ie parent hyphen center, you'll find that. And we also have a WhatsApp channel where we'll give you any updates for talks such as tonight, such as this webinar. This is our first webinar of this type, and it's very much in line with what we're trying to do in StudyClicks. We do a lot of this type of thing for students, and we try and support students as they're preparing for exams, and even from first year, how to be an effective learner, how to make your first study timetable. We very much don't want to feed into the whole kind of panic and anxiety side of study, and it's a you have to get 600 points and all that type of thing. It's very much about trying to support students, they're young people, and they're trying to navigate through what can be a very stressful time. So I absolutely think we're going to do more of these webinars with Richard and with other guests. But I might just pass over to Amanda, who's tried to distill some of the themes and the questions. And if you want to just put them to Richard or to myself.
Yeah, good stuff. Brilliant stuff, guys. Since I was talking at the beginning, it's gotten considerably darker outside as well. So I'm kind of glowing at this lamp on and everything. But I've been keeping an eye on the chat there throughout the session. Some fantastic questions coming in. I think the biggest takeaway is that there are so many topics that we can apply to future webinars. It's kind of hard to cover everything tonight. So great suggestions and ideas for future ones. But one that did come through that I think would be particularly interesting to touch on is a question around how hands-on the parent should be when it comes to encouraging their child who seems unmotivated or kind of disengaged from studying, that they're conscious they're getting pressure from all angles, teachers, peers, you know, especially this particular question was an exam student, a third year student, in fact. So what is the boundary with the parent? You want to be encouraging, but you don't want to be another voice at that table.
No, that's a great question. And you know what, the reality is sometimes you have to do a bad exam, you know, and sometimes you have to underperform. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, that's actually one of the greatest motivators of all time, is to kind of see, oh God, the process wasn't good. I didn't do good. And this is what the outcome going to be. And so from my, like, again, you know, as a parent, what you're trying to do is help them to see their potential without being overly, you know, because, you know, they will resist, they will push back against that if there's too much. If it is, you know, again, that Michael Foucault, where there is power, there is resistance. And so if you're too much, they will resist you and push you back. All I'd ever say to my daughter particularly is, like, I'm not going to drag you over the line here. You know, because you can't make your child study. I'm saying you have to figure out what it is you want to bring into your life, and you want to figure out what you want to feel like next year. And I just try to plant the idea of the image in their head, rather than being the, we need these points, you need to get this, you need to get distinctions. I'd say, you know, how do you want to feel? Feeling is a much better. How do you want to feel? You want to feel proud of yourself. Because I ultimately don't think there's a better feeling than when you put good processes in place and you achieve something. I'm not talking about 625. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about, you know, when you achieve and you bring something into life, into reality that you accomplished because you had good processes. You realize that you're actually in control. You realize that you have power. That is the greatest antidote to anxiety and low, you know, self-esteem and all that, that you see, I have control of myself. So I'd say to them, how do you want to feel next year? Think about that guy or that girl, you know, when she gets her results, what does she want to feel? When she goes out with her friends that night, how does she want to feel, you know? No one's expecting you to get all, but we want you to think about your potential and how to go about achieving that. That's what I would be doing with my own child, rather than going get up and do your Irish now, you have to get your, I wouldn't be doing that stuff. I'm just saying, you know, what is it that you want to bring into life here? Currently what you're doing here is not going to bring that into life. You have to really figure this out for yourself. I'm not dragging you over the line, but that's kind of what I would say there. Yeah,
very good.
Just to add to that, sometimes I would suggest, like, all their advice and motivation advice doesn't necessarily have to come from you as a parent. You could connect them with an older cousin or whoever, they respect and admire, and just have another voice that they actually will listen to. Sometimes that can help as well. Don't think you're the only person who can advise your child.
That's a good point. We had some questions that kind of dealt with the other end of that spectrum as well. Some parents are concerned that their students are kind of going too hard too soon when it comes to study. You know, we're still only the second week of September, and a few questions around, is it too soon to be studying so many hours at this stage in the year? Is it too soon to start grinds? I suppose parents are just concerned about that burnout.
Well, honestly, I've worked with this so many times, Amanda, and like the brain is designed, and we're in an age of like hyper productivity. They're hearing on TikTok, to achieve anything, you have to break your day down to 3 6-hour days, and you have to do this and this and this and this to achieve anything. And it's absolute rubbish. I worked with a guy there recently who just got his Leaving Cert results, and he was telling me, you know, that he spent last year just going around going, I'm going to get 625, 625, and he was studying till 12 o'clock at night. And he said by April, he was done. He couldn't fit anything into his head. It was like that glass with the, everything spilling out, and he was trying to put more information in. And that April, you know, that April, May is a really important time to be able to just put your foot down a little bit, where he was absolutely spent. And so if you're trying to put things into coded memory, you need receptors in your brain to be nice and thick and to be able to take in information. What depletes that? Excessive, you know, study, chronic stress, burnout. That is terrible. And so if a student wants to do well, they need to have downtime. They need to be not studying. They need to be 17. I mean, God, when you think about it, they need to be 17 or 18. They need to be young, meet their friends, go out. I mean, when you're doing that stuff, those receptors are growing back. That's the antidote to kind of like stress and overwhelm, is to actually take a break and kind of go, all right, there's more to life than this stuff. I've overdone it. Pull back a little bit. That's a really important thing to do. They shouldn't be going hell for leather right now. They should be getting nice habits going, stacking good habits, nice getting into it. It's 9 months if they're in sixth year, and it's like, you know, 2 9 months if they're in fifth year. It's a long old marathon there. So there's nothing immediate, and I would make sure that they're not studying past at this point, you know, 8, 9 o'clock at night. They don't need to be doing that kind of work, because they will get burnt out.
Yeah.
And I see it, like, I see, you know, a lot of questions popping in from the younger, you know, first year, second years. And again, I go back to that point. They're coming from national school where the extent of their studying is revising for the spelling test that's coming up on the Friday, right? And then suddenly we're putting them in first year. Like, your school, you know, many schools, some are doing better jobs than others, but they're not teaching the students, your child, how to be an effective learner. It's not like someone on a Friday morning spending 4 hours talking through it. So as a parent of a first or second year, rather than saying how much time are they putting in, you can actually sit down with them and show them how to be an effective learner.
Exactly.
Right? And again, I'm not trying to sell StudyClicks here, but go on to StudyClick Study and go on to the blog. There's a lot of free resources. If you just look under study advice, you will see a lot there that you can use to assist your child. Because often what happens is that when the child gets to second year or first year, and you might be seeing, okay, they're struggling in maths and it's algebra, and you can't remember how to do quadratic equations because it was 15 when you did them last yourself. This is where the likes of StudyClicks can help you, because you now have a bit of a structure. You can take a quiz with your child, or you can look at a video with your child. So it's really just rather than forcing them to spend the time, you can actually help them learn the skills of how to learn. And that's why StudyClicks is relevant for a first year or a second year. Or let's say they've got a CBA, a classroom-based assessment coming up. You have resources to help you with that. So think of it like we're there trying to hold your hand to help your child through to become an effective learner, because you want them to be self-motivated, self-disciplined, self-sustaining themselves. By sixth year, you shouldn't be sitting at the kitchen table showing them how to learn, because they know what they're doing, obviously, at that stage. So maybe we'll take one more question, Amanda, if that's okay. And then
yeah, I think we talked a lot this evening about phones and social media and everything. Some really useful insights there. Again, I think it could be a webinar topic in and of itself. But an interesting question came in around establishing phone boundaries for when your child is 16, 17, almost 18, and maybe boundaries you didn't set in their early teen years, and trying to do that now, maybe when the time has passed, but you still want to be effective.
Well, it's back to that kind of thing about rowing back, you know, and bringing one small change in, because, you know, if you're 16 or 17-year-old, 18-year-old, you know, they're adults now. I wouldn't be checking my 18-year-old's phone. To be honest, I wouldn't want to know what my 18-year-old daughter is getting up to on her phone at that particular time. When she's 14, I want to be all over it, right? Because of, like, I know risk-averse thinking and all that part of the brain isn't developed, so I'm trying to help her along there a little bit. Again, it's just about rowing back a little bit. It's just about bringing in one manageable rule. Parents, when I used to, you know, give these talks, they'd go off and they try to bring in all the rule changes to a 15-year-old. It's just too much. Too much is too much. You know what I mean? You're trying to bring in one thing that you can do. And that's what I'd say. One thing that's manageable. And then you build on that. And then you build on that, and all of a sudden you look around, you kind of go, well, we've got a good few boundaries in place here. That's pretty good. But you start off with one manageable thing first.
Yeah, very good. Perfect.
All right.
There's a couple of, like, logistical questions, just if you're curious about the recording of this webinar and getting access to it. Don't fear. We have it recorded and we'll be sharing that out over the course of the week. The newsletter that Luke mentioned there, that's part of our parent centre, definitely give that a Google tonight and sign up to it. It'll be one of the first places the recording will appear. But of course, as attendees of the live webinar, you'll be first to receive the recording as well. So thank you very much for your time, everyone who's attended, and the engagement in the chat has been fantastic. We've lots of fruitful ideas to kind of proceed forward, and opportunities to collaborate with Richard in the future as well. So thanks to the two lads for their time also.
Yeah, and it will be like Amanda said, this will be the first of many more like this. So we will note down all the questions that we didn't get to. I see there's a lot of mentions of dyslexia there, which I think is probably a webinar in its own right.
Actually, I'm actually an ambassador for Dyslexia Ireland.
Okay, well, there we go. So we will...
I happen to live with it myself.
Well, there, oh, sure, of course, yeah. So let's do
my daughter lives with it too. So, I mean, yeah, it's very important because that's a voice. That's a voice that talks to a child that tells them they're stupid. And you're really trying to unpack that stuff.
Yeah, let's do one on that. And like I said, the call to action for you guys is just... go to StudyClick's parent webinar, or sorry, what is it again?
Parent Center,
and sign up for the newsletter and you'll be notified of future ones of these, and feel free to share with any other parents out there who might find this helpful. So look, thanks a million to Dr. Richard Hogan, thanks to Amanda, and thanks to everyone who attended this evening.
Thanks a million, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
And that concludes the Back to School webinar with StudyClick's and Dr. Richard Hogan. If you found this podcast useful, we'd really encourage you and appreciate it if you could share with a friend. Once again, you can check out the StudyClick Parent Centre for more free tips and resources on how to support your child in secondary school. The link is in the description. You can check out more of Dr. Richard Hogan's stuff by following him on Instagram @officialrichardhogan. Bye for now!